Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, August 23rd, 2014. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. 1 week from tomorrow, there will be elections held for the state parliament in Saxony, which is a state in the eastern part of Germany. The political situation in Germany right now is quite fluid. Maybe it's not yet volatile, but there is a strong undercurrent of dissatisfaction both with the existing government, but also with the direction overall of Europe. Under Chancellor Angela Merkel, Germany has continued to stick to the dead-end financial policies dictated by the European Union, in which Germans are paying a very high price for bailing out failing banks and to cover the tracks of criminal speculators. And despite the efforts of some networks to engage in a dialogue with Russia over Ukraine, the German government is continuing to adhere to the line pushed by Obama and British Prime Minister Cameron, and this is the British imperial line, which is for a NATO military buildup on the borders of Russia and economic sanctions against Russia, even though these sanctions are now directly negatively impacting the German economy. On our program today, we're going to be discussing both this daunting reality that's facing Germany if it remains under the dictatorship of the European Union and NATO, as well as the prospects for a break by Germany from the British imperial control that's being imposed on it by the EU and NATO. Joining me on the program today will be Carsten Werner, who's the lead candidate for the Busso slate in the August 31st Saxony election. I might add that Carsten is from Leipzig, and 25 years ago, the movement which brought down the Berlin Wall and collapsed the Honecker regime in East Germany and began the end of the Soviet Union, that movement was born in Leipzig. Also joining us today will be Bruce Director, a longtime friend of the program, sometimes host. Bruce recently spent several weeks in Germany working with the Busso campaign. So, Carsten and Bruce, welcome to the program today.
Good to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Carsten, let me start with you. With the election just days away, I already know from just trying to contact you how busy you are. What are we doing? What's the lead edge of our campaign there?
Well, hello to all the listeners of the program. Well, the lead edge is obviously preventing a war breaking out. And I'm not talking about the war in Ukraine or the conflict in Ukraine as the media portrays it, but really the open military conflict between NATO and Russia. And this is almost on everybody's mind. And what we're doing here is trying to find enough people in the German elite, establishment, politicians, whatever you want to call it, to break away from, as you just said, this crazy NATO, EU, US government policy. And there already is a big brawl. People might know or might not know that there's the two main German economic institutions or representing corporations. One of them said the sanctions against Russia are okay. We can pay for them because we need to show strength against Russia. They need this now. And the other side is saying, no, this is absolutely unreasonable. This cannot work. It will harm the German economy. And we're saying, obviously, this will actually lead to war. So what we're trying to do in these last days of the campaign is just really cover all the area of Saxony. We have barely over 4 million people living here. So we're going out with a new poster that says Russia is a partner, not an enemy. And this is really, really polarizing because there's a lot of bottled up anger that's now coming out because the media line, which I guess is similar to the one in the U.S. media, has always been unipolar against Russia, against Putin, almost like if he's the new Satan. And people just notice, since they have the experience from over 25 years ago, that this is just black propaganda without much arguments. So they come up to us and say, yeah.
That's an important point because, you know, years ago, and we talked about this many, many years ago, that at the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall, there were people who referred to Saxony and Dresden and that area as the Valley of the Clueless because of the East German propaganda. So obviously people are familiar with this kind of propaganda. Are you finding that there's counter in the media, or is it just that people have an understanding that they know better than to believe the line that's coming out?
Well, I think it's two things. It's one, what you just said, that people know both sides of the propaganda. They know the propaganda they've grown up with from, you know, the Soviet Union and everything that you connect with it. But they also know the propaganda now after the fall of the Soviet Union from the West, that everything is great and beautiful. And since there was a big collapse of, or a big destruction of industry, you know, under that system after the fall of the wall here, people know it's not working so well. But they also know that the Soviet Union didn't work so well since it collapsed. So they think twice before they believe something. The other thing is that even much more important is sometimes the knowledge of a people goes way back before their own existence. And I think that's really what's resonating, because if we're saying here that Saxony has a historic connection to Russia, we're not talking about the Soviet Union. I mean, obviously, that's a part of it, the GDR being a country inside it. But we're talking about Leibniz, the great universal thinker, was actually born in Leipzig, who met Peter the Great, the Russian Tsar, twice, and they collaborated, and this led to the founding of the Russian Academy of Sciences. You have the Mining Academy in Freiberg, which is still a world leader today in this kind of area. So there's a long history of collaboration between Russia and Germany, especially also in Saxony. And if you just go against this with very superficial arguments again and again, you stir something up in people where they sense this is just not right, this is not in our interest.
Karsten, what I'd like you to do is to give our listeners a sense of what is Saxony, the cities, you just touched on this, the history is very important, and it's important for our campaign. So I think it's important for Americans to get a real understanding of this. So let's hear your Saxon patriotism.
Okay. Well, there's few areas in the world where you have such a high density of, you know, geniuses, pioneers in industry, culture, music. I mean, you find them everywhere in the world. You know, every country has its genius, but in Saxony, you have a certain density where it's just inspiring, you know, and everybody, that's why we need to develop the world, so we have these kinds of geniuses everywhere. I mean, I just mentioned Leibniz was born in Leipzig, but, you know, he traveled all the world and influenced all the world. You have Bach coming originally from a neighboring state, but living and working there at the same time of the great mathematician Abraham Kästner, was a big defender of Leibniz and sort of continued that tradition. You have both Schumann, Clara Schumann and Robert Schumann, the great composers. You have Lessing, you know, you could call the founder of the modern German language, is born in Saxony. And the list goes, you know, on and on. So all this is, you know, sometimes a little bit piled up under some dirt, and you need to sort of, but as soon as you mention these things to people, they become proud again, and there's the glimmer in their eyes. And I think this is similar to what we need to do in the U.S., where after so many years of crazy and bad and evil presidents, you need to sort of reawaken the real patriotic tradition of the U.S., you know, from the founding father, George Washington and Franklin. Because, I mean, also the U.S. and Germany once had almost always had a really good historic relationship, which was important for the development of Germany, but also for the U.S.,
So, Karsten, what are we then calling for? You mentioned not having a war, but what's the program that you're running on?
The program is very straightforward. It's 5 points. We say, first, we need to reintroduce Glass-Steagall. So it's the same fight you have in the U.S. You know, really solve the financial crisis by reorganizing the banks. Speculation you have to do on your own with your own private money. If you lost it, too bad. And some people probably might need to go to jail. Second point is that we say absolutely no to a bail-in like last year in Cyprus, where people's deposits were just expropriated if they had over 100,000 euro. Third point is that we need to use national banking, like the first two American U.S. national banks, or regional banks that can be used for the same purpose with a credit system, where the fourth point, you then create full employment. I mean, you have a lot of unemployment in Saxony right now, but you focus on high technology and infrastructure. And the fifth point, maybe the most important point, is a Eurasian Development Alliance, where, you know, we go beyond what we have right now and just intensify the relations with Russia, with China, by actually building the Eurasian land bridge at the same time while we're reestablishing a classical culture with the kind of geniuses I just mentioned. So that's the program.
And, you know, this is a pretty exciting program. And what are the people for running for the CDU or the SPD or the left parties? What do they have any program at all? Are they just all stick with Europe? We need more Europe?
Oh, they almost have absolutely no program. They're, if you look at their posters, it's embarrassing because, you know, the Liberal Party, which is called the FDP, they just discovered that Saxony is not Berlin. That's what they write on their posters because, you know, that they're having big losses on the national level, and so they want to say about Saxony is different. Or they say in love with Saxony with a, you know, nice-looking woman on the poster. And then the CDU is just going with the faces of the candidates and nothing else. And it's just crazy. They're counting on the summer lull because right now it's the big summer vacation. So just, you know, go as usual, get your 40%, which is now the CDU, Merkel's party. But, you know, they really don't have any program. And every time we bring up these big issues in, you know, podium discussions, election events, because there are some, not many, they say, oh, no, this is a global policy or this is a federal policy. We're talking about state policy and we can't do that. But we bring up the very important point that, remember 89, the people in St. Nicholas Church demonstrating against the wall, saying we want out. They were not officially responsible for the wall or for tearing down the Soviet Union, but they did it. You know, when the time is ripe and the idea is right, then you need to stand up.
And Bruce, you were just over there. You did some work with Karsten. You addressed some meetings. You met some of the candidates. Are you finding that our candidates as a whole, the ones you met, are highly motivated given what otherwise seems to be a pretty dead election campaign?
Well, our candidates are actually pretty unique because they're not really professional politicians or politically ambitious people. They are ordinary, I guess you could call extraordinary Saxonians, and who embody what Karsten was just saying about the history of Saxony and so forth. They're very proud of it. They are also, you know, involved in, you know, the ordinary daily activities of life there. So what is kind of interesting, I found coming from the outside of Saxony, is what Karsten mentioned, that there really is this sort of pride in this historical culture. Saxony has historically been one of the most economically and culturally advanced, scientifically advanced regions of the world, let alone Germany. And it's always had this strong connection to Europe and Asia. Leipzig, for example, lies at the crossroads of the two ancient roads which went east-west and north-south. And the road, the Via Regia, which starts in Spain and ends in Kiev, goes right through Saxony and then hooks up to the ancient Silk Road. So there's a real sort of cultural identity there that Saxony plays is at a crucial crossroads in both time and space in terms of its geographical location, but also in terms of its historical location and what it represents for the future. And this is embodied in our candidates list, who are, you know, as I say, they're people from ordinary walks of life, but they're extraordinary in that they really understand this crucial role that Saxony could play. I think the other crossroads that Saxony is in is really represented by the program that Karsten outlined, which is the Buzo program. And that is that, you know, right now, the world, the human race, is at a crossroads. For the last 250 years, or 500 years or so, the center of progress in mankind has been Europe and then subsequently North America. But that's declining because of the stupidity, especially over the last 40 to 50 years, but really accelerating over the last 15 years, of the moral, financial, economic decline in the transatlantic region. But on the other hand, you've had a real progress, a real shift for mankind made in China in particular, which is really taking the forefront in terms of scientific, cultural, and economic progress. They've done some tremendous things. And the point is that right now the U.S., Europe, especially the U.S. and Germany, are, because of the misleadership of Merkel, Bush, and Obama, has really becoming completely irrelevant in the world. And it's our job to basically break that and get these become more relevant. And I think a good vote for the Buzo in Saxony is kind of a very interesting opportunity for the people of the world to express themselves, that they want a shift in the crossroads of the direction of mankind.
Well, Karsten, in this context, before the program, you were telling me that that Leipzig is a terminal on the Silk Road. There's a daily train coming from China. I mean, are people aware of this in Saxony, and do they have is this part of the sense they have of being connected to the East?
Actually, not so much. So we have to sort of tell people that even the people in Leipzig, some people know it. Some people know there's a train station up there, but a lot of people just don't know it. So, but when we tell them, they really get a sense, oh my God, this is actually real. And I think it has a lot to do with what Bruce just mentioned, that the center of the world is shifting towards Asia. People are very, very aware of that, and not just, you know, they don't say it, you know, China is the yellow danger. I don't know how the U.S. media says this, but this is sometimes
The yellow peril is the old saying from the U.S.
Ah, okay,
well,
yeah, no.
Well, on this, look, I want to delve a little bit into this whole question of the war that's taking place in Europe now, because Ukraine is part of this Eurasian-Europe-Asian crossroads as well. Is there much awareness that there was an external-run coup in Ukraine, or do people buy the line that it's the Russians and Putin who stirred this thing up?
People might not know in detail, but just because the media is so hardcore against Russia, and no matter what, it's always against Russia. People get a sense something is not right about it. There's a lot of people now, especially younger folks, who go on the internet and they read about it, and they then know that this is a coup d'etat. And then if we tell people who don't know yet that this was a coup d'etat, that the West has, or all these NGOs have been heavily financed, the right sector was involved, people are not so surprised. But a lot of people are shocked that we did support real neo-Nazis in toppling that government, only because they are Nazis that are against Russia. Because, you know, especially in Germany, this is a big issue, you know. And the big scandal, since we're talking now about Ukraine and I'm here in Saxony, is that last year, the right-wing Svoboda Party that sits until recently sat in the Ukrainian government, the coup d'etat government, met last year with the German right-wing party, NPD, that everybody makes a big fuss about it, if we should ban it, they're so crazy, they're right-wing and they're against human rights, and that's because of Germany's historic past. So, but they met with each other, and we don't say anything about these guys. So it's just crazy, you know. So we're saying, how can this be that the German government, with this kind of history, you know, doesn't say anything about it, even tolerates it?
And also on the Ukraine situation, you know, what initially was the issue was the Yanukovych, the Ukrainian democratically elected government, rejecting the EU. And, you know, I know in some parts of Europe now there are growing sentiments against the EU. The most recent vote from the European Parliament last summer, the leading vote getters in France, in Britain, in Greece, were the anti-EU parties. But it seems as though in Germany that it really hasn't taken off yet. Is that just submission to the, you know, sort of a continued colonialist-type response to having been occupied? Or what's your sense of that? Why is it that there's still this, or is it changing, the support for the EU?
I think it is, but it's changing around the foreign policy question. It's not changing so much about on the you know, Europe as such, because people have been brainwashed very heavily on this question that, you know, the EU only exists because of Germany and the past, and we need it. It's good for our economy. But now, ever since this conflict with Ukraine and then Russia broke out at the end of last year, people get a sense that the EU and the German leadership around President Gauck and Merkel is really playing a bad role. And that's why they're turning now more against it. And they don't have a big problem of saying for example, in worst case, if we keep going like this, we should leave the European Union and we should leave NATO.
And are there problems? Do you see yet an effect from the sanctions? Because on the one side, the sanctions against Russia will mean that there are German goods that are not going to be shipped, that commerce in generally is going to be cut back. But then the Russians issued counter-sanctions, which is especially hitting agriculture. I mean, are people beginning to pick up on this? Is there support for the sanctions, or what's your sense?
Well, as Bruce noticed also when he was over here, we haven't met a single person that would, you know, have liked to have war with Russia. So that's an obvious point. And the sanctions, people also almost universally against it. The agricultural sanctions that Russia now just imposed on the EU are not hitting Germany so much. It's more Poland and the countries more close to them, which they're getting their imports from. So, but the industry sector is really hit by the sanctions, the EU sanctions against Russia. There have just been several meetings in the last days, which is not usual because we're in the summer vacation, but they made them on short notice, meetings by industry trade chambers in Thuring, neighboring state, but also here in Saxony, on the effects of the sanctions. And in the neighboring state of Thuring, they're talking about a loss of 100 million euro. The trade with Russia in that state accounts for 3% of the total GDP of the state, but some single companies have 20 to 30% of that trade with Russia. And I think in Saxony it's even bigger because we have even more companies that sometimes are mainly producing for Russia. And there are some things where it might not affect them so hard, you know, if you have a single contract only once. But there's a lot of these one-year contracts where you need to know now if the contract runs from January to December of next year. And nobody knows what's going to come, if there's going to be more sanctions. So there's a big fuss, you know, because people don't know, can we continue this business? And people want to trade with Russia. So this is, we have a picket here on our book tables when we organized for population saying sanctions against Russia are sanctions against Germany. And people get a sense of that.
And Bruce, one of the areas the sanctions are hitting is scientific cooperation, especially we see that in terms of NASA relationships with the Russian space program. But Germany still has, in spite of the idiocy of this anti-nuclear policy of the current government, Germany still has many high-tech companies, scientific engineering firms, and so on. I don't know whether you had a chance to meet with people in Germany there, but what's your sense of the effect this is going to have in terms of the potential cooperation that could exist if we didn't have this Obama-Cameron duo under the Queen running policy?
Well, this is really the obvious point in German politics, but also in American politics as well. I mean, Germany, you know, as an American, we always grow up hearing the term German engineering, and we marvel at the precision and the real care with which German technology sort of leads the world. I mean, throughout Germany, you have these small companies which make very precision machine tools and parts and other things which are sort of essential for, you know, much larger industries. And so if you shut down that capability, you know, the whole world suffers. And everybody knows this about Germany. It's part of the German identity. And yet, on the other hand, you know, you have this EU NATO operation, British Empire operation, which is basically saying, you know, what's more important is our geopolitical games and not reality. So there's a real, you know, to use a strange term, a cognitive dissonance between what is clearly in Germany's historical and future interests and the policy. I mean, the thing that's the thing that's and especially in the areas of advanced technology. I mean, Germany invented the maglev, but there's no maglevs in Germany. They're in China. Mm-hmm. Germany invented the high temperature gas cooled reactor, the pebble bed reactor, but Germany's now going out of nuclear energy, and the Chinese and South Africans And Brazilians are all building this technology. Germany, you know, at once was a real pioneer in magnetohydrodynamics and fusion energy research, and this is all being picked up by the Chinese. So you really have a sense of the total bankruptcy of the British Empire and the leadership of Germany, which is, you know, pushing in one direction, and the historical tradition and current interests of Germany, which are going in the opposite direction. And my sense when I was there is that people are seething about it, but, you know, one of the things in the German character is you're allowed to be angry about the policies, but you're not supposed to do anything about it. And what I found in Saxony is the one place in Germany that I've been where I talk to people, that people really feel like they should say something about it. They should do something about it. There seems to be more of a rebelliousness among the population, a sense of independence than I found in other parts of Germany, and less intimidated, at least in my discussions, than others, less resigned to accept the fate that the EU has bestowed on them.
Karsten, do you think that may partly be related to the fact of the initiating role played by handfuls of courageous people in Leipzig in bringing down the so-called German Democratic Republic, the Honecker regime?
Yeah, I think so. It's still a big item of pride in everybody that, you know, we did that. I mean, that's connected to that as a big disappointment that it didn't work out. But now, as we are going towards another big crisis, people sense it, and people, what Bruce just said, I mean, on the tables we meet like people who, you know, usually wouldn't say much or wouldn't take a stance on this, would just sort of walk over. But there's a highly politicized situation right now with the war question, but also people just, you know, the Ebola thing breaking out in Africa, the wars in the Middle East that are, you know, worse than ever, you know, even worse than 10 years ago when we started to invade Iraq. People just get a sense that something is really wrong in this world, and they're honestly worried. And as Bruce said, people here tend to speak up more openly about it. And, you know, even normal people just get politicized right now and are open for our ideas.
You know, Harley, I spoke about this often when I was there, and I was reminded of it, you know, of the situation we had around the Texas primary campaign with Keisha, where, you know, we didn't pick the fact that Texas would be the first election of the 2014 cycle, but it sort of fell into our laps that, you know, this was a state where LaRouche has this historical support, and we had this, you know, Keisha was a great candidate and a great spokesman for these ideas and a exemplary leader, that it gave us an opportunity to really push in this Texas primary campaign to set an agenda for what politics would be. And we did that because when Keisha announced and said, you know, she was going to impeach Obama and fight the water project, I mean, nobody was talking about it. Now everybody's
actually, Bruce, you know, even more than that, we said from the beginning, and this was Keisha's starting point, that we're not going to let the 2014 midterm elections in the United States be determined by the usual stupid hot-button issues of gays, guns, taxes, budget deficits, but we're going to focus it around the impeachment of Obama and Glass-Steagall. And these are the two leading issues in the United States.
Right, and now everybody's talking about them. And here we have the situation in Saxony where who would have expected that a state parliamentary election during the summer pause in a sleepy little corner of Germany could actually be ground zero for a beginning revolution to shake Europe and the United States free of this EU-British Empire policy. But it very well could be with what we're doing on the ground, and if that translates into a sizable vote, it could be a shock that starts to shake the foundations of European and American politics. And that's necessary because people got to wake up. As Lynn said yesterday, I mean, the fact of the matter is, or 2 days ago, that the you know, the U.S. and Europe right now, from the standpoint of the future of mankind, are becoming almost irrelevant. There's not much going on in Germany or the United States that's of great benefit to the future of mankind, except at this point, except for the fact that the United States still has enough nuclear weapons that, if put in the hands of a madman like Obama, is still capable of starting a nuclear war. So that's got to be shifted. I don't think, as Carson said, you know, you don't meet people who say, "Yeah, let's go to war." And I think we're presenting an alternative, which I think really, especially by bringing to light what's going on in China, what the potential is in Russia, and the BRICS developments, the developments around the BRICS nations, that, you know, people are saying, yeah, let's join that and let's kick out this corrupt leadership that we have, like Obama and Merkel, and let's start taking our countries back.
Well, you're listening to the LaRouche Show. This is our program for August 23rd, 2014. We're speaking with Bruce Director, and we're also speaking with Carsten Werner, who's joining us from Dresden, Germany, where he is the lead candidate of the Busso slate in elections that will be taking place a week from Sunday. Now, I want to just continue on this theme of our historic intervention, that is the LaRouche movement, and also to keep up front this idea of what opportunity beckoned to us in 1989. And Carsten, I assume you were born then. I don't know how you were a young boy. Did you participate in? You did participate in some of these Leipzig demonstrations, didn't you?
My mother took me to one of those demonstrations when I was 5 years old.
And I assume that many at one point these grew to be quite large. At that time, in 1989, Lyndon LaRouche had already been put in prison by George Herbert Walker Bush, largely because the effectiveness of Lyndon LaRouche's intervention in the Reagan administration, which got Ronald Reagan to go along and, in fact, bring LaRouche in as a part of his administration to negotiate the Strategic Defense Initiative. At the time, LaRouche said if the Soviet Union didn't adopt it, it would collapse within 5 years. Well, 5 to 6 years later, the Soviet Union was collapsing, and Bush put LaRouche in prison, but his wife, Helga Zepp LaRouche, launched a very effective campaign in Germany, but also in China and elsewhere, for this idea of the Silk Road, high-speed rail, scientific and technological collaboration. And today, China Daily has a major featured piece by Mrs. LaRouche. I believe it's an interview. On its headline, something like "Silk Road is the road to peace." Now, Carsten, given the historic importance and of the LaRouche movement in Germany and this fight, I think our listeners would just like to get more of a sense then of how we're taking this to the population, what we're doing. We have book tables. What else you're doing? I know you're doing radio. Just give us a sense of the in-depth nature of our campaign and how this connects to this history.
You would probably like to hear that we got inspired a lot by the Kesha campaign, because we learned that you did a lot of radio ads, you know, trying out new things like the hanging banners up from these bridges on the highways, you know, all kinds of things that sometimes we didn't have, you know, just the bare financial means to do it. But now we had such a good resonance in the population that we decided we're going to go full out. We're going to raise the money that we need. And so we have the possibility to do a whole bunch of things that we haven't done before. So we're going to be on statewide radio. We're going to be on local radios. We're going to be on local television. We have a 90-second video election spot that is shown on also statewide TV. We have these book tables. We call them walking rallies, where we just have a banner saying either, you know, we Germans want to stop world war, or in Saxony, the economy has to grow, which rhymes in German. And then we have somebody with a megaphone, myself or other candidates and some other people, you know, walking through downtown areas of cities where people usually, you know, stroll along shopping, and then they hear somebody talking about important issues, you know, turn their heads, and then they get our material in the hands. So that's we've sort of been walking through different stores downtown, just, you know, talking, getting people engaged, reaching out to all kinds of institutions. So there's just a lot of things going on. And one of the things with when you mentioned the history that's really interesting is that the sanctions, the whole anti-Russia campaign, really backfired. You know, not just in the sense that the German population, or especially the East German population, doesn't buy it, but that it's getting quite the opposite effect. That, you know, that Russia is now having more relationship with China, more with India. Egypt is turning to their side, Iran, Argentina, and you. I mean, this has Mr. LaRouche has been really focusing on this. That, you know, more than half the world's population is already building a new economic order, which is exactly what you just mentioned, Holly, the type of system that Lyndon LaRouche and Mrs. Helga Seplerush have been working for and proposing since the 90s, the so-called Eurasian land bridge. And people are aware that China and Russia are the, you know, the two main powers in the world, especially in Eurasia, that we need to work with. You know, even if you don't like Putin, you can't work around Russia. You can't govern without Russia in this world. People get that. So if we then show them in our program, our written program, the Eurasian land bridge map, which is, you know, very nice to look at. You have these corridors that we're talking about from Europe to Asia, the ancient Silk Road, the other trade routes that Bruce mentioned. People get really excited and say, well, but how are we going to do this? And then you say, well, for example, the already mentioned train from Leipzig to China, it already exists. You know, this cuts the travel time more than in half. It's a beginning, you know, but it's every day. And there's another train that goes three times a week from China to Hamburg, a big important trade city in Germany, also Duisburg, which is the largest Binnenhafen, interior port, which is not directly on the ocean in the world. Yeah. And so all these things are happening, and then we tell them, look, this is us. This was our idea. We were fighting for this for decades, and now it's becoming a reality, and you can take part of it. And we have the companies here in Saxony, like in Görlitz, which is directly on the East German border to Poland, where they have a company that still exists. It's now headed by a Canadian company, but that's building rail cars, you know, and this is going to be, we just have to massively expand that, not just building rail cars, but maglev rail cars. All these things, right now, that city, Görlitz, is, you say, well, it's poor because it's on the border to Poland, because Poland's not so well-developed as Germany, but we're going to turn this around and say we're going to be rich because it's on the border to Poland as soon as we really start going for the Eurasian land bridge. So you just, you know, turn people's still existing pessimism around by saying, look, this is already in motion. People have heard of this. I also should say that people on the streets have heard about this BRICS development, also the development bank, and they get a sense of what this means. They get a sense, finally, this is an alternative to the crazy IMF World Bank debt slavery, and they have good credits for infrastructure, the type of things people need, and we could just be a partner. Why should we go down with NATO and the EU?
Karsten, when I was in Saxony in 2009 and 2010, and you and I had some time, we had some good time together and visited some of the great cultural centers there, but one of the things that I saw in meetings in Leipzig and in Dresden was that, this is 2009-2010, a shock that an American was speaking against Barack Obama. At the time, uh-huh. There was somewhat of a wellspring of hope that he would be a transitional figure, transformational figure, that he would be good for the United States. It's understandable after Bush that people wanted to change. But what's the sentiment now? How are people viewing Obama and the United States from what you're picking up from your campaigning?
Well, I'm relieved to tell you that this has changed. Almost exactly around the time that the Russia war propaganda or anti-Russia war propaganda started about a year ago, people really started admitting that they're really disappointed and angry at Obama as the same way as they were about Bush. Because, I mean, what you just said, I don't know if people got a sense of this 4 years ago, 5 years ago, that people were like frantic about Obama. You know, he's like the new messiah. He's gonna change things. You know, first Afro-American president, wonderful. And then sort of people gave him a lot of time, probably even more time than in the U.S., where I know that over 70% would like to see the guy gone. But now I'm happy in the sense that people realize he's no good, we need to change, and that we have an alternative to present to people, which is what you guys are working on, trying to impeach this guy and just get the policy where, you know, the U.S. would join the BRICS. Why not?
And, Bruce, I know that you have had a chance in the last days to talk with Mr. LaRouche about, in particular, how we have to, in the United States, highlight this question of the BRICS and this alternative. At the same time, we have to get rid of Boehner and Obama to clear the way for that. But what's with these Egyptian developments? Mr. LaRouche has been extremely optimistic, hasn't he?
Oh, yeah. And because, you know, LaRouche understands the power of the imagination. And I'm just struck while listening to Karsten speak, and I'm really fortunate and happy to have had the opportunity to be there in Saxony. But, you know, when he describes walking down the streets and in the cities in Saxony making, you know, these rallies and so forth, you know, you're walking down streets where Leibniz walked. You're walking down streets where Bach walked, you know. You turn to the left and there's a building that was the school that Leibniz was educated at, or a church where Bach performed every Sunday. And, you know, you think about what came out of Saxony really was the power of the human imagination to envision a new state of existence, which you know, that never existed in the universe and was brought into existence by the power of the human mind. I mean, you know, the ideas on which the United States was founded were thought in the minds of people who walked the streets of Leipzig and Dresden.
Especially Leibniz.
Yeah, and I was struck also, I watched on the Buzo website the little clip you had, Karsten's, up there about the education program you have, your fifth point. And, you know, here you are standing there in front of the Semper Opera, and you make the point that Dresden was once called the Florence on the Elbe. And this is really how you can be optimistic, because you just see all around you the power of the human imagination, and that, you know, this is what we embody and what we're evoking. And it's so much different than the, you know, the BS politics which go along. He describes these stupid posters from these other parties and what's passing for politics in the United States. But this really is, you know, the key, which is, can we activate the imaginations of the people to start thinking about the great things that made it possible for us to even exist, and how the imaginations in certain parts of the world are still very active, and that's where the hope comes from.
Right. I was just going to say, Karsten, I think this is a very important point, because I know you came out of somewhat, let's just be kind and polite, a pop culture background. And, you know, what was it that attracted you initially to the ideas of LaRouche?
Well, this was about 11 years ago. This was also a highly politicized situation, already very dangerous. But compared to now, I mean, it was maybe mild. But this was the Iraq War when, you know, the 9/11. I mean, 9/11 sort of changed everybody's life in my generation, I think. And then after that, you sort of started becoming really concerned of, like, where the hell is the world heading with this kind of policy, you know, invasions of countries in a way that hasn't really been seen before, and such a density and an audacity. And then that happened, and then I met LaRouche's movement, was at a big international conference, and I was just so excited about, because I had debates with my father, for example, before I joined the movement about, you know, why the world is in such a bad state and we should do something. But I really didn't know, like, what to do. You know, how can you actually have a new system? How can you actually sustain 7 billion people on the planet and give them a worthy future? And when I was at the first Schiller Institute conference in around Frankfurt in Germany, I got really excited, you know, by all these people from all these nations there, the ideas of the land bridge, the development projects. So I just kept asking myself, well, I don't know how you say this thing, but what's the hook, you know? What's the catch? You know, it's also great. And the catch was, well, you got to do something yourself, buddy. And so I just said, okay, I got to join this movement. But I was just going to think, I was thinking about another thing that people might be happy to hear, because when we talk to people here about these projects, about what we want to change, they're very much in concordance when we say, you know, no war with Russia, no sanctions, we should work with the East in this sense. But quite often, an anti-Americanism pops up in the discussions, which is, I guess, also a little bit of a historic heritage here. But it's easily shifted when you just purely mention the name of John F. Kennedy. Sometimes the facial expression changes immediately. People say, yes, this was a president. That's what we need. So, I mean, people still have this image of John F. Kennedy as a good American leader that everybody wants, that everybody's longing for, because even if they might be sometimes a bit anti-West or anti-American here around this area, they want a good leader. I mean, that's what they wanted in Obama, which he has obviously not, but John F. Kennedy just expresses for a lot of people an unideological, optimistic leader with great visions going beyond the existing things, you know, with the moon landing, the sovereign policy of defending the state, with the, you know, getting away from the Federal Reserve, getting out of Vietnam, you know, fighting with the steel bosses, all these things, just a real leader. That's what people want.
I think that's very important, because what we're fighting for here is the real America, you know, and what people see as America. You know, you see these race riots now in Ferguson, Missouri. You see the desperation of unemployed. You see with Obamacare. By the way, this is another point. When I first was telling people what Obamacare is in Germany, they were saying, oh, no, this is good. This is the government health care program. And I said, it's not government health care. But now that we're seeing the effects of it, the shutting down of hospitals, you know, the what people see as America today is a materialistic entertainment society, social networking, but no depth, no substance to it. And right. What Keisha did with her campaign was to call on people to say, look, America was a nation that cared for the sake of the little people, giving people hope for the future. It wasn't just all about how rich you are and how many cars you have and designer clothes you wear. And I know that when you look back at Germany, the turning point for Germany really was the Bismarck period, where Germany took the American system economic policies and actually went beyond the United States at that time with the unemployment programs, the so-called social welfare state. What's left of the social welfare state in Germany with the Hartz reforms and everything else? It's getting tougher for people who don't have means, and I'd like to also direct this, Carsten, on the question of the youth and the future. I know there's been mm-hmm. a real loss of young people, maybe even a big part of a generation that left Saxony after the reunification for lack of opportunity. What's the situation with young people, and are we able to reach them in the campaign?
Yeah, that has been a big problem that we have also openly discussed, that, you know, the youth of today, what you just walked through with U.S. entertainment culture is obviously also carried over here. You know, social networking, people being pretty dull, concentration spans under 30 seconds, you know, that's nothing unusual. So it's a big challenge to mobilize these people. But, you know, it's different. You still find, you know, here and there people that just because of the craziness of the whole situation do respond. And but it's a result of the policy, you know. It's really not their fault in a sense. I mean, they could change it, but, you know, look at the culture, look at the economic conditions they're coming out of, and what you just raised with the Hartz-IV laws. I mean, that was the big thing that we here in Saxony campaigned 10 years ago under Helga Zeppler-Rusch's leadership against Hartz-IV, which was, you know, the changing of the social welfare state into much, much lower conditions. And Helga Zeppler-Rusch called this the biggest break in the social welfare system since the existing of the German Republic, since 1949. So we did that, but unfortunately it wasn't changed. We created these mass Monday demonstrations like in 89 again, and Chancellor Schröder was about to change the law under public pressure. But then, you know, all hell broke loose, and there was German bonds being sold by a special system, an attack on the German government. There was I believe it was even the American Financial Times that said the Monday demonstrations in Germany are a threat to the financial system. So there was just huge pressure being put on him. And then, unfortunately, he bowed under the pressure. So this still keeps going, and it creates a very low-wage sector. You know, we have one of the highest, one of the most low-wage working people here. And that's really creating a pessimistic culture where people are not usually so fond of reacting, but you know, the question is, how far can you go? And people often also tell us this, you know, old line that, oh, it still has to become worse, so people react. But I say, well, no, because if it really gets really bad, you know, when people are fighting for their food and stuff, they're going to only be worried about themselves and not their common population. I think it's different. It's when a time is ripe, like in 89. You know, people weren't starving in 89 in the GDR. There were a lot of bad things, but they weren't starving. But there was, at a certain time, enough is enough. I think it's really, I really truly believe in these principles that were embedded in the U.S. Declaration of Independence, that if you violate the principles that a government was founded upon too much, then the population will turn against you, it will lose its respect, and also the fear, even if it's a dictatorship. And as soon as that happens, if a government doesn't have the respect, if it's not feared by the population, then it's over. And I think we're approaching a kind of moment like this now.
And it's crucial in that kind of moment that there be a leadership to take people who are suddenly angry and give them a deeper understanding of what the mission of man on this planet is. You know, Bruce, you've done a lot of work on this, on the destruction of science as a key contributing factor to this, what Lynn always calls the degeneration of the younger generations. Why don't you say something about that?
Well, you know, I think that's kind of the point. That's why I raised this question this education program. I was quite struck by it, the little video that Karsten had up there on the Buzo website, because, you know, as I say, you know, Saxony in particular, Germany in general, but Saxony in particular really was always in the forefront of science and industry and culture. And, you know, it's like a real jewel for humanity. And yet it's in such disregard by even many of the people who live there. You know, in other words, it's there, but it needs to be awakened. And what is really a great opportunity for us that this election campaign is occurring at this time in history is that the crisis almost makes it, possible to awaken something which otherwise would probably lay dormant. And I think that's really something we need to always keep in mind in thinking about these next 8 days or 10 days before the election, that we're really awakening something which is a really central part of the development of mankind. At one point Saxony was the center of real human progress. And it's there, and we need to just awaken it in the imaginations of people. And I think the young people, who have their whole lives ahead of them, really need to grasp that. It's not just a question of the old people looking at the situation and saying, yeah, we once had this capability, but it's really the young people whose future this depends on.
Go ahead, Karsten. You wanted to say something.
Yeah, I mean, I was maybe just to go a bit more into the detail. People might know this, but the young people of today, you know, what are they doing? Either they're unemployed, they're selling cell phones, and, you know, you have almost every 10 meters you have a cell phone shop, or, you know, they're selling stupid contracts in a phone call center, and all these things here. So what kind of identity does that represent? I mean, really nothing, totally superficial. You don't believe in the work you're doing. So what we've discussed here in the last just days and weeks is, with the employment program that we're talking about, you know, reinvesting in the infrastructure, rebuild the infrastructure that's broken, that will give people, we need training programs like the CCC under Roosevelt, I really think. So we need to get people out of their usual environment, you know, have a training program. People become proud in the work they do. They get a connection. Well, this actually means something. I'm taking part in the sustenance and also the future existence of my community, of my society, and maybe even of the world, because I think we're going to get a bigger sense of identity and of humanity in the whole if we don't just, you know, repair the existing infrastructure, which has to be done. But then with the BRICS development that's already underway with the Eurasian land bridge, you know, people know that from there, you know, in front of their house, a train is leaving every day to China. And they might know a person leading that train, for example, you know, And, you know, it just becomes much more common that the world is right next door. And then people just get a bigger sense that, you know, you have this old story where a guy walks past three workers. He asks the first guy, what are you doing? And as he says, well, I'm polishing some bricks. And the next guy says, well, I'm polishing some bricks, and I'm putting some things together, give it to the next guy. And the third guy says, I'm building a cathedral. Right? Cool. So it's three people doing exactly the same thing, but the third person just has a bigger idea. And that I think, is the task of the government. Just give people a real inspiration of what humanity is, what it can create.
And Carsten, where can our listeners go to see... I know it's probably in German, but give out the website so people can take a look at what we're doing, what you're doing there.
Yeah, if you go on the main BUESO page, which is just www.bueso.de, just right on top you see a big banner, Saxony 2014. You click on that and you can get video, statements, written stuff, program, what you want.
And how many people do you have right now working with the campaign there?
Well, we have around 15 people full-time. We are getting a lot of support from the other German locals because, you know, everybody's excited and really sees a chance here to, what I said right in the beginning, that we can break away Germany from this crazy alliance and into this new future alliance.
And how many candidates are on the slate?
On the slate, we have about a dozen, and you have a different system here. You have a slate of people running, and then you have, similar to the U.S., you have a... in each district, the people living in, they can vote for a candidate in that district. That's another list. So we have 30 of those candidates. And as Bruce was talking about before, they're from all walks of life, but they're people who have been following our ideas. They're excited. You know, one guy is working on construction sites all over Germany, so he has a good sense of what's going on. Another guy comes from the mining city of Freiberg, so he knows that history. You have some younger people. So it's really quite a good, an optimistic army, I would say.
And Carsten, you mentioned that you're going to be doing some radio spots. Just summarize for us again, we just have a couple minutes left. What are you saying in these radio spots that are going out to the people of Saxony?
Well, the newest one says something like, are you sick and tired of the anti-Russia propaganda too? The NATO, with its confrontation course, could risk a world war. But if we want a real future, we need Russia and China as a partner in big development to get Saxony on its foot again, too. So if you agree with that, you should vote for BUESO.
And how many of these spots do we have?
Oh, to be honest, I sort of lost the overview. We have so much campaigning, so we have a lot of division of labor, but we have at least two different radio channels that are statewide that are airing this, and then we have several local radio channels that are airing this, and then we have TV channels, radio channels, but to be honest, I lost the overview.
Well, it's not surprising. Carsten, I want to thank you for taking time out in the middle of the campaign. You've been listening to Carsten Werner, who is the leading candidate of the BUESO party in Saxony, where there will be elections on August 31st. So Carsten, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Bruce, I'm sure we'll be hearing from you again soon. Thank you for joining us. And this has been another edition of the LaRouche Show, this one for August 23rd, 2014. We probably will have some report in the next couple of weeks on the program, on the results from Dresden, but you can follow this by going to the BUESO website. So until next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, this is the LaRouche Show. We'll join you then again.